From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we're keeping an eye on the huge storm hitting California today, the biggest rain event there in years. There are flood advisories across Southern California. We're also monitoring a slower-moving threat of flood that has prompted the governor of North Dakota to order the evacuation of a camp that's been at the center of a protest against the Dakota Access oil pipeline. Republican Governor Doug Burgum issued the order this week because of the threat of rising floodwaters along the Cannonball River and is demanding that people there clean up and leave the camp by February 22nd. Governor Burgum joins us now. Welcome.
Great to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, you also cited the risk of environmental damage to the river because so much trash and debris have piled up on the land over the past few months of the protest. What are the conditions of the camp now?
To say it's a ecological disaster might be an understatement. Our assessment yesterday in conjunction with the tribe and with the Army Corps of Engineers, we've already got about 160 acres in the campsite. About 30% of that's already under 4 inches of water. But this is North Dakota. We've had record amounts of snow, and now we've got record warming happening right now. It's supposed to be over 50 degrees this weekend. There's possible rain coming this weekend. This is, you know, a month ahead of schedule in terms of the melt. We've got hundreds of abandoned vehicles in this area, propane tanks that were there used and abandoned for heat sources this winter. All that stuff could be floating down the Missouri River. And as people recall, this whole thing began with the idea of water protectors, and now we find ourselves in this tremendous irony, which is the people that sought to protect the water have created one of the largest ecological messes on the entire Missouri River system this year, which is that all of this camp debris could be floating down towards the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe water intake.
We've talked with a Native American protester who says, look, we know the land. We're not going to put ourselves in danger with the flood. Let us clean up and leave on our own time. What do you say to that?
Well, the tribe and the state of North Dakota and the Army Corps of Engineers have had a very collaborative arrangement around this idea that nobody wants to pollute the water and everybody wants to clean up. And there has been about 2.5 weeks of what I'd call organic camp-led cleanup work, and that's, you know, been productive. But if you're just going to get this down to roll-off dumpsters per day, there have been slightly over 100 dumpsters have come off in the last 2.5 weeks, and we might have 400 more dumpsters that need to come off. And so you'd say, hey, it's been great, but it's not anywhere near the pace that it should be to allow the remediation. Because this isn't like sending high school kids out and, you know, walking a ditch and picking up garbage. I mean, we're talking about like landfill-size mountains of garbage where you need front-end loaders, roll-off dumpsters, and trucks in an environment where if you have 2 or 3 feet of water, that equipment's not going to be able to operate. This is not about free speech. It's not about protests. It's not about any of that. This is about, hey, we've got a mess to clean up and we need to do it together.
But isn't it about protest to some degree that people see this order as an effort to limit people's right to protest?
Well, they might, but in my mind, they'd be delusional because they have all of America to protest and have free speech. They can go anywhere they want to and conduct that right. At least in the state of North Dakota, we're asking that if they're here, they help clean up to help protect our river, our water, and protect the tribe.
Are you going to ask police to intervene if people don't comply?
We have made it very clear that this is the time for people to grab their personal belongings. And as it would be in any flood situation, if you've got people that are preventing contractors from doing the cleanup work, or if the people that are contracted to do the cleanup feel threatened by, you know, any kind of self-designated security group in the camp, those kinds of confrontations we're going to have to deal with on a one-by-one basis. But ideally, there are no arrests. Ideally, there's full cooperation because we're all on the clean water team. Everybody's got to be on the clean water team at least for the next week while we're trying to get this camp cleaned up.
One more thing, Governor. A lot of people inside the Washington Beltway have been watching the Trump presidency over the last several weeks, and they've seen it as chaotic. People were stunned by that press conference yesterday. What did you think of it as a Republican governor in North Dakota?
Well, I didn't, you know, watch the press conference yesterday, and so I've been, you know, focusing on a leader here about the things that we can control and trying to, not let news and commentary of the national press, you know, drive our agenda. But you know, myself and the First Lady, Lieutenant Governor, I mean, you know, all of us feel so grateful that we can get up every day and make a difference in the lives of people in North Dakota. And we can do that regardless of what's going on in Washington, D.C., because there's so many things that we can, so many things that we can do, and there are so many important things to work on. You know, in the, you know, the issue of Native populations in America has been, there's been a long and tragic history, and there are so many things, whether it's education, capital formation, jobs, healthcare, addiction issues, and, you know, part of the reason we want to get things cleaned up and protect our environment now is so that we can, you know, move on and work on the issues today where we can, you know, have a chance of making a difference for future generations.
So no concerns right now about the Trump presidency?
Well, it's a, you know, I mean, it's when you think of it from a historic standpoint, you have an individual that took down the Republican the Republican establishment, including knocking out, you know, the biggest brand name in Republican history in recent decades, the Bush family, which, you know, even 2 years ago, it was going to be, you know, Bush versus Clinton. Trump takes them out and then turns around and does the impossible, whichever is impossible, is, you know, take the biggest brand name on the Democratic side out and blows that. So if people thought it wasn't going to be chaotic, I mean, after watching the election process, I'm not sure what people's expectations were, there would be anything but chaotic. I mean, if it worked to disrupt the existing political structure in America, which people thought was impossible, then why wouldn't you, when you start governing, also be a disruptive force? So, I mean, I'm not anybody that's shocked about this hasn't been paying attention.
But do you think that that's okay for the presidency to be chaotic in that way?
It's different. I don't know if it's okay or not okay. I mean, bureaucracy is, you know, was stifling our country, and we know that socialism doesn't work. If we have a disruptor in the White House, this could be the perfect thing for right now, because the world's changing very quickly and government changes very slowly. And there's a lot of things that government does that is broken, particularly at the federal level. I mean, I get to see it every day running the state. I'm, you know, completely comfortable with disruption in Washington, D.C. You know, we have to have leaders that understand that there's a tremendous opportunity for improvement over the status quo right now, and we have to keep fighting for that.
That's North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy. I appreciate your interest and appreciate everything you do at NPR. Thank you.
And now to the Keystone XL pipeline. President Donald Trump revived the project when he took office, but the final say on whether the pipeline is built may lie in the Midwest. Grant Gerlach from member station NET Nebraska reports that rural landowners are promising to challenge the president's plans.
The pipeline would carry 35 million gallons of oil per day through rural Holt County, Nebraska, not far from Jeannie Crumley's kitchen.
The pipeline would be about 400 yards north of my house, running through a creek out here where cattle water and where we draw irrigation water.
Water is one of Crumley's main worries. Her family raises cattle and corn here. The pipeline would run above an aquifer that provides water for thirsty crops and livestock. TransCanada, the company in charge of the project, says pipelines are safer than hauling oil by train and that it would clean up any damage. But Crumley says an oil leak in her groundwater is something she just can't afford.
The purity of the water is essential, and it's the thing that probably is driving the resistance.
In 2015, it looked like that resistance had paid off when the Obama White House rejected Keystone XL. But 4 days after Donald Trump's inauguration, he directed the State Department to approve it.
We'll see if we can get that pipeline built.
That announcement has revived resistance in Nebraska. Dozens of Holt County landowners recently gathered in a community hall talking strategy over pie and coffee with Jane Klebb. She's the leader of the anti-pipeline group Bold Alliance.
We certainly don't have somebody in the White House right now that we feel like we can influence a lot, but we think we can stop it here in the state.
Klebb says TransCanada still must have two things from Nebraska before it can build: a route approved by the state and contracts with all landowners, either voluntarily or through eminent domain. Sarah Shore with the climate change activism group 350.org says pipeline opponents are planning federal lawsuits to stall the pipeline, but landowners in Nebraska could be an important obstacle.
Keystone XL can't be built without eminent domain. If we stop the route through Nebraska, we stop the pipeline.
Keystone XL does have supporters here. Governor Pete Ricketts promotes the potential for new tax revenue and jobs for about 2,700 construction workers in Nebraska. In Holt County, the Board of Supervisors passed a resolution against the pipeline, but Chair Bill Tilkey was surprised when he heard from people upset because they want it built.
I had probably more calls with people wondering why we had done the resolution than I ever did on people calling to say to do that.
Holt County is deeply Republican, so the pipeline is not really a partisan issue locally the way it is nationally. But farmer Jeannie Crumley says it is quietly divisive.
We have to live in the community with our neighbors. We go to church with our neighbors. So we get along, but at a superficial level. The rules of the game now are you don't talk about something controversial.
But now the Keystone XL debate is back, whether people like it or not. And this part of rural Nebraska will have a big say about the pipeline's fate. For NPR News, I'm Grant Gerlach.
You might remember this exchange in President Trump's press conference yesterday. It's between him and April Ryan, White House correspondent for American Urban Radio Networks.
Are you going to include the CBC, Mr. President, in your conversations with your urban agenda, your inner city agenda, as well as
Are you going to include
the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional
Well,
Hispanic
I would.
Caucus,
I tell you what. Do you want to set up the meeting? Do you want to set up the meeting?
No.
Are they friends of yours?
I'm just a reporter.
Set up the meeting.
I know some of them, but I'm sure
Let's
they're
Let's go set up
right
a meeting. I would love to meet with the Black Caucus. I think it's great, the Congressional Black Caucus. I think it's great.
Well, the Congressional Black Caucus says that last month it did send Trump a letter, but no one from the White House responded. Joining us on the phone now, Congressman Cedric Richmond. He is a Democrat from Louisiana and chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. And Congressman, your reaction?
Let me just say that the day the president was sworn in, we sent him a response to his New Deal for Black America, his 10-point plan, which we thought was incomplete. We sent him a policy agenda with legislation because, look, we represent 80 million people collectively with the Congressional Black Caucus. It's only 17 million that are African-American. So it's a very broad range that we represent, and we wanted him to know that.
Just to get the facts straight here, I hear you saying that you sent these letters, including an agenda and goals that the CBC has. But strictly speaking, did the letter invite the president to sit down at a meeting?
No. The letter told the president that if he was serious about those agendas, he should start with the CBC, and here are some pieces of legislation, and here are some ideas. And we didn't hear from him. We didn't get a response to the letter. We didn't get anything. Mm-hmm. And until that exchange yesterday, and that's not a serious manner in which to invite 49 members of Congress to have a conversation, including two U.S. senators.
But is this now the opportunity for the CBC then to formally issue an actual invitation for a meeting? I mean, because that it seemed the tweet that the CBC put out yesterday said, "Hi, real Donald Trump, we're the CBC. We sent you a letter, as you mentioned, on January 19th, but you never wrote us back." But as you're saying, the letter didn't extend a formal invitation. Will you invite the president now?
Well, after that, what I thought was not a serious effort. We did get a serious request to meet, so I am talking to the administration about setting up a meeting. He's the president of the United States. We're going to meet with the president of the United States.
So tell me more then about the kind of conversation that you hope to have with the president, because as you well know, during the election, during the campaign, he said, to Black voters, quote, "What the hell do you have to lose?" in terms of he painted a picture of Black life in a certain light that made it seem as if he was the best option for them. So what kind of conversation would you like to have with the president?
Well, one is going to have to be educational, because I think the president needs to be educated on African-American life, African-American issues, and the fact that all inner cities are not crime-infested cities, and that a lot of it centers around economic opportunity. So we have a number of things that we can help him if his goal is to really make a difference. And I think the American people right now, our biggest question is whether this president is serious at all about anything.
Congressman Richmond, let me ask you a question about African-American voters and the Democrats, because earlier this month at a Democratic retreat, you discussed a CBC post-election analysis that showed dissatisfaction with President Trump, but also with fellow Democrats. I mean, you talked about how African-Americans feel taken for granted by the party and want more drastic tactics to fight policies. And then you said African-Americans want Democrats to stop using the same old playbook and make substantive progress. So tell me more about that.
Well, about 68% felt that the party takes them for granted, which is true. I'll even admit that. I think they're saying you just can't take us for granted. You have to come talk to us. We're not just going to vote that way because you have a D behind your name. And I actually think that that is very healthy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Congressman Cedric Richmond is a Louisiana Democrat. He's also chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. Congressman Richmond, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
On Sunday, HBO is premiering a new show the network's been vigorously promoting, part murder mystery, part upper-class intrigue drama. It's called Big Little Lies. And let's listen to a clip here. It's a conversation between a few of the moms in the neighborhood in the show. They're welcoming a newcomer played by Shailene Woodley. And she's explaining that she does not have a husband or boyfriend.
He's not in the picture. He was actually never in the picture. We weren't together.
Really?
Where'd you move here from?
To Santa Cruz. I was up there with my parents.
Mm. Oh, you know, she does part-time bookkeeping as well.
Isn't that great? You know, I work at the theater, and whenever we go into production, we hire freelance accountants. So I'll ask them if they have anything for you.
You're so nice. Thank you.
This is Monterey. We pound people with knives.
To death.
Joining us now is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi there, Eric.
Hey.
Okay, so Big Little Lies, what's the premise of this show?
So it's a little tough to explain, but basically we get an up-close look at the lives of about five women who are parents to elementary school-age children, and they're all part of this community in Monterey, California. It's upper middle class. There's a couple of rivalries going on there, and the backdrop to all of this is that it starts that with a murder. Someone has been killed, and we sort of follow the detectives as they come to the crime scene, and then over the course of the series, we get little tidbits of scenes where the police officers are interviewing different parents who are part of this community. And then we also see scenes play out where the various characters get to know each other, and we see how the rivalries start to build and the frictions start to build. And so this story is kind of about all the different frictions that can happen between mothers of elementary school age kids. And at the backdrop, we have this sort of outrageous situation of a murder.
So Nicole Kidman, Reese Witherspoon, Laura Dern, and many others, it's a pretty high-powered cast.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this is that Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon are executive producers on the show and apparently were heavily involved in trying to get it made. Now, it was written by David E. Kelley, who people will remember as the creator of Ally McBeal and The Practice and Boston Legal and a bunch of great shows. And it was also directed entirely by a male. So it wasn't completely sort of female-led, but you do have some very powerful female actresses who are, you know, not only the creative force behind the scenes as well as starring in it. And it's another example of TV offering a great role or a bunch of great roles for actresses who are reaching a point, reaching an age where Hollywood is resisting casting them in great movies. So Laura Dern and Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon, we've seen them as film actresses. Now they're getting, you know, a shot at roles on television that, frankly, I don't think the movie world would allow them to play. And it's turning out great. I mean, you know, you're getting great projects and they're getting great parts.
Yeah. Well, we've got another clip of the show here, so let's listen to it. You're going to hear Reese Witherspoon's character, Madeline McKenzie. And this is the moment where she first meets Shailene Woodley's character, Jane Chapman.
I'm a stay-at-home mom myself, so I'm happy to welcome another full-time mom to the ranks. You know, sometimes I think it's like us against them, the career mommies. Them and all their various board meetings that are so important. Google this, Yahoo that. Please, I think they spend more time on those board meetings than they do actually parenting, if you know what I mean.
So I got to ask you about this, Eric, because, I mean, granted, it's a TV show. Maybe I hope for too much out of television. And you said there's a mystery, you know, wrapped up there in the background. But as a mom myself, I'm kind of tired of the mommy wars here. So at least tell me there's a nuanced exploration of the frictions.
Well, it depends on what you mean by nuanced. I don't think this show is amazing. I'll be honest. I was a bit disappointed by it, but I like what it's trying to do. And I do think it's kind of odd, though, that you have these women who are, you know, executive producers as well as starring in it, but ultimately the words were written by a male and the shows were directed by a male. And part of me wonders if it wouldn't have felt a little more revolutionary and a little more groundbreaking if we'd had, women involved in those roles as well.
Yeah. So, Eric, one last thought here. It seems as if Big Little Lies is just one of several projects that really have women or female characters at the heart of them. And I'm going to say that's a pretty good thing.
Yeah, it is. Last year we saw a bunch of great shows that featured black characters, Insecure on HBO, Atlanta on FX. Now, this year, I think we're seeing a lot of great shows that star women and not only star female characters, but women are creative forces behind the scenes as well. So we have The Good Fight, which is a spinoff of The Good Wife, starring Christine Baranski's character, Diane Lockhart. We have a show called Feud from Ryan Murphy, featuring Susan Sarandon and Jessica Lange as Joan Crawford and Betty Davis, depicting their classic old Hollywood feud. And Ryan has committed to having at least half of the episodes on every show that he does directed by women now. So this is going to be an interesting time. I think we're going to see some nuanced depictions of women's lives. And hopefully this is the first step of an increasing progression where more women are featured not only in front of the camera but behind the camera, and they get a chance to tell the kind of nuanced stories that, you know, are specific to their experience in the same way that we've seen some really talented black executive producers and stars get to do last year.
Well, that's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
Those little TV monitors you watch on the back of airplane seats may be on the way out. Many airlines are now planning to phase them out, choosing instead to stream movies and TV shows directly to your electronic device. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us now. He's in New York. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what's behind this move?
What's behind this? Well, American Airlines is leading the charge on this change, and they sent a memo out to employees, and they said more and more passengers are traveling with their own personal devices. Seems pretty obvious, and the metric they've got is that 90% of passengers already bring their own device and screen with them, allow people to connect to the Wi-Fi system, and then they can stream from Netflix and from other services. And then if you want to be able to surf the web even more, then you can buy an upgraded package. It'll be free for certain things, the access to the Wi-Fi on your own device, but then you're going to have to pay a little extra if you want to be streaming from your own services.
And when is this likely to happen?
Well, American Airlines just ordered a new fleet of Boeing 737s, and they're expecting delivery on those later this year. And those new planes not going to have the seat back entertainment screens that you're used to.
It's interesting because American Airlines has a lot of new planes already that just put in these TV screens. So I guess it's a pretty quick turnaround on that. What does it mean for airlines? Are they going to save money if they don't have to install those monitors?
Yes, indeed. I mean, these screens, believe it or not, can cost as much as $10,000. You could buy a really nice flat screen for your home for $10,000, a huge one.
Or for a lot less than that even. Yeah, right.
Imagine what you could get for $10,000. And it's, you know, it typically actually costs about $3 million to outfit an entire plane. Plus, these things carry weight, and weight over, you know, long term adds up in terms of fuel costs. The more weight extra weight you're carrying, the more fuel you're burning.
But anybody who has ever used Wi-Fi on a plane knows that it isn't always reliable. Do they think they're going to be able to manage all those people using their devices and streaming movies and TV shows?
Apparently so, and the airlines are upgrading their satellite internet. And I mean, I've noticed myself that it's been improving over the years, and you know, now it's not bad. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether they can handle that capacity. I'm not sure that we've really seen that truly tested when you've got a plane full of people who are on Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, another thing that airlines are phasing out or bringing back in this case, Delta bringing something back, free meals on long economy class flights. Tell us about that. Since 2001, they got rid of free meals in economy.
That's right. I mean, and if finally we are able to bring you news that you're getting something back, not taking away something, not taking away your right to bring even hand baggage on board. I mean, it's really been a rough stretch for passengers. But yeah, on Delta, long U.S. flights, they're bringing back on some of these long haul routes, 12 of them on Delta. They're bringing back meals. They did some polling and they did some sort of focus group testing on certain routes. And the data that came back to them, the polling that came back to them showed that people love them. And so it can be a competitive advantage to get people to buy a Delta ticket versus one of their competitors. And so it's likely, according to analysts, that other airlines are going to follow suit. You know, it's always like, if something works on one airline, they'll bring it back.
Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal. Jason, thanks so much.
Thank you.
At his press conference yesterday, President Trump had some pointed words for the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. Turmoil. Chaos, he called it. The Ninth Circuit issued the opinion that's held up the president's executive order on immigration, the one which revokes the visas for visitors from 7 predominantly Muslim countries. Now, Trump has lashed out at the federal judiciary before. Earlier, he criticized what he called the, quote, broken legal system and said even a, quote, bad high school student would rule in his favor. Now, some legal scholars say that Trump is undermining the judiciary, but history shows the president and the court system have a record of not getting along. For a look at that, let's go to Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly. They're historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Brian and Nathan, welcome.
Hey, Magna.
So, first of all, this isn't necessarily the first time that the executive has clashed with the judiciary. So, should we just not be surprised that this is happening?
Go back for us, Nathan.
No. Conflicts between presidents and the courts are a constant, right? I mean, you can go back as far as Marbury versus Madison in 1800, right? And there, you've had a number of cases prior to 1800 where the courts are reviewing cases, but the meaning of judicial review really does come about in this 1800 case. Really quickly, you have John Adams, who's lost the election to Thomas Jefferson, and he simply wants the right to pick William Marbury as a kind of midnight judge for a court in D.C., and the Supreme Court, under John Marshall, basically says that he has the authority to pick the justice, but doesn't have the right to have that authority protected once he's basically lost office. The only powers that the court has are those that are outlined in the Constitution, not that are outlined by Congress. So the fact that you have a president who wants to simply make an appointment in the 11th hour is by no means beyond the reach of the court to essentially refute.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons that that decision sticks, Magna, is Marshall was brilliant. He basically established the authority for courts to review legislation by, in essence, giving up authority, saying, yeah, right. You know, that legislation really didn't allow us to do this.
Oh, fascinating. Okay, so let's talk about some other cases that really help us define moments in history that this tension comes to the fore. I think one of the key ones is with President Abraham Lincoln and habeas corpus, right?
That's right. And Lincoln has been criticized by many for suspending habeas corpus during the Civil War, but after all, it was a civil war, and he had a very practical problem. It was very hard to tell who was on whose side, especially in border states like Maryland. So, he needed to hold people, and he said under the president's powers during wartime, he was suspending habeas corpus. He ran into an old nemesis of his,
Robert Taney.
Justice Taney, exactly.
Right.
And Taney said, no, you know, the legislature has to do this. And Lincoln, he toughed it out. He said, I'm not going to do that. I don't care what you say, Justice Taney. Now, the good news for the country is the legislature, the Congress, did meet soon after that and, in fact, gave the president the ability to do that legislatively, which made it more judicially kosher.
Okay, but let me just jump in here. But I mean, so there was a period of time, though, where Abraham Lincoln was forcing a constitutional crisis, though, if he's just
absolutely.
Like, yeah.
Right.
But Magda, you have to understand that the Civil War was a bit of a constitutional crisis as
there
well.
Was that, too.
But the
court here is saying that, you know, Civil War or not, the rule of law must stand and the president must follow it, right?
No, that's absolutely right. We've had many other moments that we can go through. I'd love to fast forward to the present, even though we're both historians.
Do so. Go ahead.
I think that what is happening right now is we look at the Ninth Circuit ruling on Donald Trump's executive order that some call a travel ban. I think what's happening now is we're seeing that words, process, and evidence actually really matter. And all through the campaign, right, it seemed like, well, words just didn't matter. Who was going to respond? Well, the courts are responding. And once something gets to the courts, what Donald Trump actually has said in the past turns out to be a very important part of that Ninth Circuit decision. The process of how that executive order has been implemented really matters. The fact that Trump did not consult with the key agencies ahead of time. And most importantly, evidence, right? The Ninth Circuit, at least the three judges, said, look, we're willing to consider what you're saying, Justice Department, but you need to show us some actual evidence that there really is a threat to security here. And if you don't want to make it public, we will consider that in camera behind closed doors, but you need evidence. And so I think we're facing the first time that Donald Trump's words are coming back to haunt him because the government, at least up till now, has operated with certain processes and based on certain fact-based evidence. And they're all coming together right now.
So my backstory brother is a little bit more optimistic than I am on this one. Mm-hmm. And I see actually in Trump's maneuver something that feels very similar to what Teddy Roosevelt tried and failed to do around the turn of the century, around 1912 actually. You know, when he tried, and he in this case failed to win the presidential nomination, he still raised the question of a much more populist engagement with the judiciary, right? He wanted to be able to recall judges, to have popular elections for federal and state judges, and this commitment to a kind of popular sovereignty basically ran on the idea that the people should have the influence over the judiciary. And what I see now in President Trump's efforts through, you know, delegitimizing the judiciary, through his tweeting, through his attempts to speak directly to the American people is, in effect, a kind of Rooseveltian move, right? The idea that the American people should be able to check their judges and then, in some cases, be run by a very charismatic and strong president.
I mean, I can see what both of you are saying, but to me, does the fact that both truths exist simultaneously not speak to the fundamental strength of what's written in the Constitution and that the Republic has survived these tensions as they've played out repeatedly over various administrations?
Well, it has, but I want to go back to Nathan's good point about Teddy Roosevelt. You know, he was considered a progressive, a liberal reformer, especially in 1912. And what he was saying, even more specifically, was that the people had the ability quite literally to overturn a specific decision by a court. Now, he was referring to the state courts. But that's really pretty radical stuff. And if you're listening, Donald Trump, I agree with Nathan. Teddy Roosevelt sounds a lot like you in this case. and what, you know, the only reason that Madison v. Marbury has been listened to is tradition and precedent. And we know if Donald Trump is one thing, he's a disruptive force who has never met a tradition and precedent that he doesn't want to disrupt.
The other thing about how some of these conflicts between the judiciary and the president play out has a lot to do with who's in Congress, right? When Congress has the back of Lincoln in 1861, that makes a huge difference, right? Roosevelt is able to, this is, you know, Franklin Roosevelt is able
We'll tell you about Freddie on the next show.
The long lost brother.
or even, you know, Andrew Jackson in 1832, right? He's able to win in his debates about Indian removal. Jefferson in 1807, again, wins against the court relative to embargo on U.S. goods because he has Congress behind him. So in this instance, it'll be very curious to see what happens when you have a Republican Congress, you have a Republican president, you even will have a predominantly Republican judiciary at the Supreme Court level, at least. And it's going to, in very real terms, I think, set the tone of how these conflicts between the White House and the courts play out.
But to go back to the founding, I'll point out that there was a reason that the founders made the House of Representatives stand for election every 2 years.
Uh-huh.
Because behind even the Congress itself is public opinion. And it remains to be seen how that public opinion influences Congress in real time over the next 6 months.
Well, Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly are historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. We only touched upon some of these other key moments and cases, but folks, listen to the podcast and you get a much deeper perspective on it. Brian and Nathan, it's been great. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Magna.
President Donald Trump is still looking for a new national security advisor to replace Michael Flynn, who resigned earlier this week. Trump offered the job to Vice Admiral Robert Harward, who turned it down. At his press conference yesterday, Trump has said he asked for Flynn's resignation because Flynn misled Vice President Mike Pence and not because of the conversations that Flynn had with the Russian ambassador during the transition.
Mike was doing his job. He was calling countries and his counterparts. So it certainly would have been okay with me if he did it. I would have directed him to do it if I thought he wasn't doing it. I didn't direct him, but I would have directed him because that's his job.
For more now, Greg Myrie is with us. He's NPR's national security correspondent. Hi, Greg.
Hi there.
And let's just unpack this. Remind us, first of all, of what Michael Flynn did or said on that call with Russia, as far as we know at this point.
Right. The key date here is December 29th. That's the day that President Obama imposed sanctions on Russia after U.S. intelligence agencies said Russia had tried to influence the U.S. election. So Obama kicks out 35 Russians, and there's this expectation that Russia will respond, perhaps in kind. Flynn speaks to the Russian ambassador in Washington, and after that talk, Russia does nothing. Now, is there a relationship there or not? We don't know. But that was the key conversation that everybody's been looking at as part of this broader issue surrounding Trump and Russia.
And at that point, Flynn had no official position, right? He was just a private citizen.
That's correct. President-elect Trump had named him as his national security advisor. But again, a key principle here, one president at a time, so they hadn't taken office and wouldn't until January 20th.
So when Trump said there that Flynn was just doing his job, is that fair since it was during the transition?
Yeah, it is. I mean, a new team has to get ready. One of the things they apparently discussed, Flynn and the Russian ambassador, was setting up a phone call between Trump and Putin. And that, as it turns out, took place on January 28th, 8 days into Trump's administration. So, yes, it is fair to have contacts. It is not correct to be making policy.
Is it illegal what Flynn did?
No, there's no evidence that if indeed that was what he did. We know there's a recording of this conversation. There's a transcript. My colleague Mary Louise Kelly's talked to somebody who's seen the transcript. So it depends what is said. But the fact that they had a conversation and if they discuss general issues, that's not illegal.
Not illegal. So what is the issue? Just that Flynn misled the vice president and others about what was said on the call?
That's how Trump's portraying it and the White House, and they say it's an issue of trust. It's not a legal issue. And as of right now, we don't have any evidence to contradict that.
What are we likely to see in terms of an investigation into this?
We're going to hear more about this. The Congress and Democrats in Congress in particular want to hold hearings, and there are certainly Republicans that seem to be on board with that as well. So we could certainly see Flynn called before Congress to talk about this. And again, not just this phone call, but the larger issue of Russia's role in trying to influence the U.S. election and perhaps other members of Trump's team during the campaign that might have had contact with Russia. So that's what I think we can expect to see.
Is it likely there will be any other investigation outside of Congress?
Oh, sure. I think that there probably will be some law enforcement looking into this as well. But at this stage, nobody's been accused or formally charged or anything like that.
What about the bigger issue of Russia and President Trump? They seem to be testing him right now. They've got a spy ship sitting in international waters off the East Coast. Russian warplanes buzzed a U.S. warship in the Black Sea last week. What do you make of that, and are we likely to see any response from the White House?
Yeah, it's interesting that we haven't at this point. Trump said yesterday, as Russia came up over and over again in his press conference, he said, I want to get along with Russia, but I don't know if that's going to happen. And in these early days, he's following a very traditional playbook. He sent his defense secretary, James Mattis, to Europe this week. He met with NATO, reassured NATO that the U.S. is there. They want NATO countries to spend more, but he's talked about the alliance. Mattis and the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, are in Germany today at a European security meeting. Russia's a big part of that. So he's following a playbook that any other recent president might have followed.
And meanwhile, what's going to happen with the National Security Advisor position now that he's just been turned down by Robert Harward, the retired vice admiral?
He's going to want to get this filled very quickly, simply because it's a critically important position. It's caused the first big controversy of his administration. So he's going to want to fill it. We don't know who that will be right now. The kinds of names that are being floated tend to be retired 60-something four-star generals. I think that's about all we can say at this point.
Well, we know that David Petraeus is one of those people on that list that's been mentioned as a potential national security advisor. We'll have to see what happens with that. Greg Myrie, NPR National Security Correspondent, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.